Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres visited sites of suspected war crimes in Ukraine on Thursday, where he condemned the evil violence committed against civilians and urged criminal accountability. The UN chief's visit to the Kyiv suburbs of Borodyanka, Bucha and Irpin comes 9 weeks since the invasion by Russia, which Mr. Guterres urged to accept to cooperate with the ongoing investigation launched by the International Criminal Court, the ICC.
When we see this horrendous sight, it makes me feel how important it is, a thorough investigation and accountability. I fully support the International Criminal Court and I appeal to the Russian Federation to accept to cooperate with the International Criminal Court.
Earlier this month, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said that she'd been horrified by images showing the bodies of dead civilians lying in the streets of Bucha and in improvised graves. Echoing the Secretary General's call for justice for the victims of atrocities in Ukraine, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, said that he favoured neither Russia nor Ukraine in the search for the truth. Here's Karim Khan now, speaking to journalists on Wednesday evening outside the Security Council at UN headquarters in New York.
This is not really a time for talking, it's a time for action. International law cannot be a passive spectator. It can't be sedentary. It needs to move with alacrity to protect and to insist on accountability. The law is above us, and if the law is not above us, there's nothing below us except the abyss.
ICC Prosecutor Khan launched an investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity on the 2nd of March at the request of more than 40 member states. A team of analysts, anthropologists and investigators have already examined several locations in Ukraine, including Lviv, Kyiv and Bucha. The prosecution of Brazil's former president, Luiz da Silva, violated his right to a fair trial, his right to privacy and his political rights, the UN Human Rights Committee has found. The committee, whose members are independent rights experts appointed by the Human Rights Council, issued its findings after the former president, who's commonly called by his nickname Lula, filed a complaint to the panel. He was Brazil's president from 2003 to 2010 and a target in a massive corruption probe called Operation Car Wash. Investigators uncovered corruption between the state-owned oil and petrol company, Petrobras, several construction companies and various Brazilian politicians relating to secret campaign funds. In July 2017, Lula was sentenced to 9 years in prison. This was later increased to 12 years, effectively preventing him from standing again for president during that time. The Human Rights Committee noted that wiretaps of Lula and his family had been approved and released to the media before formal charges were made. This and other incidents contravened his right to privacy and his right to the presumption of innocence, the committee said. While states have a duty to investigate and prosecute acts of corruption and to keep the population informed, especially when a former head of state is concerned, such actions must be conducted fairly and respect due process guarantees, said committee member Arif Bulkan. Africa is in the grip of a surge in outbreaks of diseases that can and should be prevented through vaccinations, the UN Health Agency said on Thursday. In an alert, the World Health Organization, WHO, said that the continent recorded almost 17,500 cases of measles between January and March this year. That marks a 400% increase compared with the same period in 2021, and it's been caused by the fact that 20 countries reported measles outbreaks in the first quarter of this year, which is 8 more than 12 months ago. Outbreaks of other vaccine-preventable diseases are also more common now, the WHO said. It pointed to the 24 countries that have confirmed outbreaks of polio in 2021, which is 4 more than in 2020. Yellow fever has also spiked in Africa, with 13 countries seeing outbreaks in 2021, compared with 9 in 2020 and just 3 in 2019. Among the reasons for this problem, WHO cited ongoing inequalities in accessing vaccines and disruption to local healthcare caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Both have impaired routine immunization services in many African countries and forced the suspension of vaccination drives. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Hi, listeners.
This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
For radio as secular as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We'll talk about why the United States needs a day of reason, not a day of prayer.
Then pioneering secular studies professor and sociologist Phil Zuckerman
makes the case for why non-religious Americans are more moral.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A pair of cruise missiles slammed into a residential high-rise in Kyiv Thursday, injuring 10 people in Russia's first strikes on Ukraine's capital city in nearly 2 weeks. The attack came just hours after United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres toured parts of Kyiv devastated by Russia's invasion just minutes after he'd wrapped up a joint news conference with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky said the timing of the missile attacks showed Russia was seeking to humiliate the United Nations and everything it represents. Guterres reiterated the UN's call for a ceasefire and said his priority is to ensure Moscow and Kyiv set up evacuation and aid corridors in Ukraine that are truly safe.
Today, Ukraine is an epicenter of unbearable heartache and pain. I witnessed that very vividly today around Kyiv. The senseless loss of life, the massive destruction, the unacceptable violations of human rights and the laws of war. It is vital that the International Criminal Court and other UN mechanisms conduct their work so that there can be real accountability.
The German and Austrian energy companies Uniper and OMV say they've agreed to Russia's demands that purchasers of Russian oil and gas open accounts in a Russian bank and pay in rubles. The Italian energy giant Eni is also reportedly in talks to make ruble payments for Russian gas. Earlier this week, the European Union accused Russia of blackmail after it shut off gas supplies to Poland and Bulgaria, which had refused to pay in rubles. The Russian state-controlled firm Gazprom continues to supply Europe with about 40% of the natural gas it consumes. NATO said Thursday it's ready to support Ukraine's military in its fight against Russia for years if necessary. The military alliance's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg spoke from the 2022 NATO Youth Summit in Brussels Thursday.
There is absolutely the possibility that this war will drag on and last for months and years. NATO allies are preparing to provide support over a long period of time.
In Washington, D.C., President Biden's asked Congress for an additional $33 billion in economic and military assistance to Ukraine. His request came as Congress voted overwhelmingly to revive the Lend-Lease Act that the U.S. used to arm its allies during World War II. Biden's latest request includes $20 billion to purchase new weapons and ammunition, including anti-tank and anti-air systems, helicopters, drones, grenade launchers, and millions in rounds of ammunition. Speaking from the White House, Biden rejected charges that the U.S. is using Ukraine to wage a proxy war against Russia.
We're not attacking Russia. We're helping Ukraine defend itself against Russian aggression. And just as Putin chose to launch this brutal invasion, he could make the choice to end this brutal invasion. Russia is the aggressor. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Code Pink's Medea Benjamin noted Biden's call for $33 billion for Ukraine is over half the entire budget of the State Department and USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development. Benjamin called Biden's request a down payment on World War III and added, quote, we need diplomacy, not billions more in weapons. The United Nations warns human activity has damaged and degraded up to 40% of the world's land, reducing the fertility of soil and stripping it of native trees, vegetation, and biodiversity. The report by the UN's Convention to Combat Desertification finds most of the damage is caused by food production, risking the ability of nations to continue feeding Earth's growing population. A new study in the journal Science finds the climate crisis poses the largest risk to marine animals since an asteroid impact wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. The study found about a third of all the animals in the ocean could vanish within 3 centuries unless humanity takes dramatic steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. With strong action to halt the climate crisis, the study found up to 70% of extinctions could be prevented. Meanwhile, a report in the journal Nature finds the climate crisis and urban sprawl are driving wild mammals to relocate to new habitats where they risk spreading novel viruses into the human population. Researchers say the change is already underway with thousands of new opportunities for viruses to spill over into new species, including humans. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with Ed Young, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer for The Atlantic. In London, advocates for a people's vaccine rallied outside Pfizer's UK headquarters Thursday, demanding the drug maker end pandemic profiteering and share its vaccine technology with the global south. Activists carried signs reading, "Pharma greed kills and Pfizer has blood on its hands," as they delivered wheelbarrows full of fake cash to the entrance of the building. Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine is one of the most lucrative pharmaceutical products in history, earning the company some $37 billion last year alone, or over $1,000 a second. In a statement, the group Global Justice Now responded, quote, "This is scandalous when more than 8 in 10 people in low-income countries still haven't had a COVID-19 vaccine," unquote. The World Health Organization warns cases of measles rose nearly 80% in the first 2 months of this year after millions of children missed out on routine vaccinations due to the coronavirus pandemic. Measles cases are skyrocketing in Afghanistan, where the Taliban government says at least 16,000 children have been infected so far this year, leading to at least 130 deaths there. Human rights groups are sounding the alarm over a surge of executions in Iran. In 2021, at least 333 people were put to death, a rise of 25% from the previous year, according to the Norway-based Iran Human Rights and France's Together Against the Death Penalty. About a third of those executions were for drug-related offenses. Groups say many of these cases lack sufficient evidence or relied heavily on confessions obtained through torture. The Oklahoma legislature has approved another Republican-led bill banning abortions after just 6 weeks of pregnancy. The measure now goes to the Republican Governor Kevin Stitt, who's expected to sign it. The bill is modeled on Texas's anti-abortion law that took effect in September. It allows any state resident to sue doctors who perform abortions or anyone who, quote, aids or abets an abortion, with rewards of at least $10,000 for those who are successful. This comes less than 2 weeks after Governor Stitt signed into law a total ban on abortion in Oklahoma that makes the procedure a felony punishable with up to 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. Oklahoma State Senator Kerry Hicks was among minority Democrats who objected to the legislation.
Forbes ranks Oklahoma number 51 out of 50 states for quality of life for women. We don't have any further to fall, and yet we are trying to prove how much worse we can make things for women through these types of legislation.
Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp has signed a raft of bills overhauling public education in the state, including one banning books deemed to be offensive from school libraries. Another bill bars classroom discussion of so-called divisive concepts pertaining to race. The Protect Students First Act also empowers an athletic oversight committee to exclude transgender children from playing high school sports. In a statement, Human Rights Campaign wrote, quote, "Self-serving politicians catering to an extreme portion of their party's base are showing they're willing to harm vulnerable kids who just want to play with their friends," unquote. Meanwhile, Governor Kemp has signed a bill instituting a flat rate for state income taxes that will disproportionately benefit wealthy Georgians. A new analysis of Fortune 100 investor filings shows 19 of the most profitable corporations in the United States are paying little or no federal income tax. The Center for American Progress found AT&T and Dow, Inc. paid zero federal income taxes last year. In fact, despite nearly $30 billion in earnings, AT&T reported a tax refund of $1.2 billion. Meanwhile, Amazon, ExxonMobil, Verizon, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and others paid extremely low tax rates. In related news, shares of Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, rose by over 17% Thursday, making founder Mark Zuckerberg nearly $11 billion wealthier in just one day. President Biden Thursday confirmed he's looking into taking executive action to cancel an unspecified amount of federal student debt in the coming weeks.
Considering dealing with some debt reduction. I am not considering $50,000 debt reduction, but I'm in the process of taking a hard look at whether or not there will be additional debt forgiveness.
In response, the debt collective demanded the White House cancel more student loan debt, writing in a statement, quote, for millions of borrowers, many of whom owe six figures, $10,000 or $50,000 of relief barely provides a dent in the amount of debt they hold. If Biden were to cancel $10,000 for all 45 million borrowers, we'd still have a massive student debt crisis on our hands, they said. Some Democrats and progressive lawmakers have also been pressuring Biden to cancel at least $50,000 in student debt, if not more. This is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking Thursday.
I again call on the president to take action, which he can do on his own, and hit the financial reset button for millions and millions of Americans. President Biden's done the right thing by continuing the moratorium on student loan payments. His actions have saved millions from financial ruin during the COVID crisis. But borrowers don't just need their debts paused. They need them erased.
And the Food and Drug Administration's published its plan to prohibit the sale and manufacturing of menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars. Menthol cigarettes are even more addictive and deadly than regular cigarettes. The FDA estimates a ban could save 633,000 lives by 2050, with the benefits felt most in the African-American community, which for years was targeted by Big Tobacco's ad campaigns promoting menthol brands such as Newport and Kool. A 2018 survey found 85% of black smokers prefer menthol cigarettes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and hello, friend, neighbor, and freethinker. This is radio for the rest of us.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. This is the April 28th, 2022 episode of Free Thought Radio. Grant Blaschka is our engineer in the Stephen Yule, or I should say it correctly, the Stephen Uhl Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall, the national offices of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
And Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, emphasis on from, as our secular constitution in the United States dictates, and our membership, we're a national membership organization, is also, for the most part, personally free from religion, and we work very diligently to keep religion out of government and educate the public about non-theism. And we would love to have you join us at ffrf.org or ask for a sample of our lively newspaper, Free Thought Today, and we'll send you a brochure either by email or by mail about our 45 years of major achievements to keep religion out of government.
And we do hope someday you will join us. We hope today you will join us. On today's show, in the second half, we're going to hear from the eminent sociologist and prolific author, Phil Zuckerman. He's the pioneer of secular studies. He teaches at Pitzer College in California. He's the author of many books, including Society Without God. And Phil will tell us why, as a group, secular people are more moral than religious people.
On our TV show this week, Free Thought Matters, our guest is Amanda Tyler of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Freedom, who also heads the Christian Against Christian Nationalism campaign. FFRF and the Joint Baptist Committee have produced a joint report on the dangers of Christian nationalism and the roots of Christian nationalism on January 6th.
And during the show, we asked Amanda Tyler about the dangers of white Christian nationalism.
Yeah, I think that white Christian nationalism, which is quite prevalent, in fact, probably the most prevalent kind of Christian nationalism we see in the United States, and certainly the most dangerous, is explains the ways that Christian nationalism often provides cover for white supremacy and racial subjugation. You know, Christian nationalism heavily relies on this false narrative of the United States being founded as a quote-unquote Christian nation. Of course, the United States was also founded on the institution of slavery and race-based segregation and all of the horrors that go along with that. And so to say that God had some kind of providential role for the United States in that history also suggests that God would endorse slavery, that God would endorse segregation, and these kinds of deeply embedded narratives that often are very difficult to unseat. This is part of white Christian nationalism. And so the language of white Christian nationalism provides all of this coded language that allows racism to go a little bit more under the surface, and it can become even more difficult to dislodge it from our society.
So you'll want to watch that episode of Free Thought Matters, and you can go right to our FFRF YouTube channel now where it's been downloaded or uploaded. The new episodes are put up every Thursday, but it also broadcasts.
And if you happen to live in one of the 13 cities where Free Thought Matters is broadcast on local TV, you can watch the show every Sunday morning. For stations and times, check our website, ffrf.org/freethoughtmatters.
And there's a lot of news in the last week, as always, to chew over. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court this week about a prayerful high school football coach. Prayer by government actors remains a divisive issue in our nation, and we want to talk about that, but let's start with the good news, and that is that we want to thank so much our home county here in Madison, Wisconsin, the Dane County Board of Supervisors, for last week officially voting to end prayer, at least to remove it as an official item from the board agendas. And they keep up inspirational messages, but which are rotated between board members, but they won't have the word prayer. And this is thanks to the activism of one of our Dane County board members, Heidi Wegleitner, who also tried to get them to stop the Religious Pledge of Allegiance. They did not do that. And I do want to mention that this is very near and dear to my heart because this is how FFRF started. My mother and I became aware of prayer at the county board and went down and thought we should call ourselves a group so it would seem stronger. And after a year, they took heed of our request and they stopped praying with Christian ministers and instituted rotating inspirational messages. And at some point in the last 40 years, they added prayer back in there. So good for Heidi and the board for removing that.
And to underscore the problem of legislative prayer, the huge foo-fara in the Michigan legislature epitomizes why our state houses and other bodies should finally drop this archaic ritual of opening with prayer.
Yeah, so it's a rather complicated issue. What happened is a senator named Lena Thies, I'm not sure how you say her name.
Thies, I think they call it.
Thies, T-H-E-I-S.
Yeah.
she misused or she took advantage of the chance to pray to pander and to politicize something. And let's listen to a little bit of her invocation.
Thank you. Please bow your heads. Abba, Father, we come to you today with humble hearts and a request for your guidance and your protection. Dear Lord, across the country, we're seeing in the news that our children are under attack, that there are forces that desire things for them other than what their parents would have them see and hear and know. Dear Lord, I pray for your guidance in this chamber to protect the most vulnerable among us. Help us to do your will at every step. Help us to come together and understand that we work for the citizens of Michigan first. Thank you, Lord, for your love, for your guidance, and your protection. I pray these things in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.
So talk about coded. Huh. She was casting aspersions on public schools for affirming gender identity, teaching what's the so-called critical race theory. And basically, this is sort of a QAnon attack. And so at least three legislators, to their credit, walked out in protest during this prayer. And later, State Senator Mallory McMorrow tweeted a criticism of this prayer. And Theist, she retaliated by attacking her in a fundraising appeal. She called McMorrow a liberal social media troll who wants to groom and sexualize kindergartners and who wishes to teach that eight-year-olds are responsible for slavery. So McMorrow responded.
On the floor.
About that prayer and the attack after the prayer, and let's listen to what McMorrow said.
I am a straight, white, Christian, married, suburban mom who knows that the very notion that learning about slavery or redlining or systemic racism somehow means that children are being taught to feel bad or hate themselves because they are white is absolute nonsense.
And then she ended with this remark.
No child alive today is responsible for slavery. No one in this room is responsible for slavery. But each and every single one of us bears responsibility for writing the next chapter of history. We are not responsible for the past. We also cannot change the past. We can't pretend that it didn't happen or deny people their very right to exist.
So this, we have asked our members in Michigan.
Good for her, huh?
Yes, to take advantage of this. We have written the leadership in the Michigan legislature to stop prayer. This shows the divisiveness of religion. It shows how people are misusing the prayer session to politicize and, you know, and even to promulgate hate. And we like to quote a decision from the Wisconsin State Supreme Court handed down in March of 1890. It was against Bible reading and recitation in the public schools, but it has more applicability. In a concurrence, a justice said there is no such source and cause of strife, quarrel, fights, malignant opposition, persecution, and war, and all evil in the state as religion. Let it once enter our civil affairs, our government would soon be destroyed. And we are seeing extremist religions, posturing and dogma entering our civil affairs, and it is indeed threatening to destroy our government.
Okay, but isn't next week the National Day of Prayer?
Yeah, and we'll talk about that next Thursday, but we are so grateful that Representative Jamie Raskin once again is introducing a National Day of Reason, and this year he's proclaiming it for the day before the National Day of Prayer, which is May 4th. If you are a member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation or have signed up for our action alerts, you're going to be getting an email asking you to please contact your members of Congress to co-sponsor this legislation. We'd really like to see a lot more legislators, members of Congress behind a National Day of Reason, and we want to applaud Representative Raskin for always taking this initiative, such a great thing to do for the Free Thought Movement and to balance the so-called National Day of Prayer, which is so inappropriate.
And Representative Raskin is also the legislator who introduced the Thomas Paine resolution to have a memorial to the
America's forgotten founder, Thomas Paine, in Washington, D.C. And we are a part of that in many different ways. And this movement just got a huge boost with an endorsement from an eminent historian. His name is David Brigham with the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, who is now championing and encouraging Congress to pass the resolution to erect a memorial to Thomas Paine.
And do you want to read who those co-sponsors are of the Thomas Paine Memorial Bill? Because if your legislator's not on there, you're a member of Congress, ask them to do it.
Representative Jared Huffman of California, that's the 2nd District. Gerald Nadler of New York. Mark Pocan right here in Wisconsin. Sean Caston of Illinois, Madeline Dean of Pennsylvania, James McGovern of Massachusetts, Mark DeSaulnier of California, and Thomas Suozzi of New York.
This should not be controversial. This should be a no-brainer, and we would love to finally get a memorial to that forgotten freethinker Thomas Paine up in D.C.
Now, speaking of displays, we want to congratulate our chapter, our freethinkers in Tennessee. There's a new billboard that's gone up in the Knoxville area encouraging people to contact FFRF if they see a violation of separation of church and state. And in our newspaper, you'll see a picture of them standing before this huge billboard that says, "Offended, concerned about religion and public schools or government? Contact ffrf.us/report. You don't have to look at the billboard. You can just do that right now.
You can go to our legal link at fff.org, and there's a report of state church violation. And then we also want to, of course, decry yet again another, it's a final blow, actually, to all of the court challenges by abortion providers against Texas SB 8, which is that abortion ban in bounty law that was instituted last September. And it's been dealt a death blow by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And although we're unhappy with the Court of Appeals, the real problem lies with the U.S. Supreme Court, which failed last fall to take any action. And at that time, Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, said this effect would be catastrophic. And then it went back to the Supreme Court in December, and they dismissed all but one of the challenges that was being brought by the abortion providers. And that's the part of the challenge that the Fifth Circuit just threw out on Monday or Tuesday of this week, so that all of that is over with. But we do want to point out that the principal plaintiff in those lawsuits is Amy Hagstrom Miller. She's the CEO of Whole Woman's Health, and she's going to be at our convention in October receiving FFRS Forward Award.
In San Antonio.
In San Antonio. And, of course, there will be some more appeals right away. Wendy Davis is got another appeal going. This is not over with, but that particular lawsuit has been killed by the Trump judiciary, basically the takeover of our federal judiciary by anti-abortion religious fanatics in many cases.
So we're going to take a break, and after the break, we're going to talk about the oral arguments that occurred this week in the lawsuit over a high school coach who was praying with the players of the football team. And we will listen to some of the comments from the justices about that case. And then after that, we're going to hear from the sociologist and author Phil Zuckerman.
Yes, and he is such a cheerful exponent of secularity, secular studies. You won't want to miss that.
And he's going to show how the non-religious, as a group, are actually much more moral than people who claim to be religious. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be right back in a moment.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. And on this segment, we're going to talk about the oral arguments this week in a very important, concerning case about religion in the schools. And we also parsed, we had our expert attorneys parse these oral arguments on FFRF's Ask an Atheist program that airs every Wednesday Central Time live. And FFRF attorneys Sam Grover and Patrick Elliott were there to discuss these oral arguments last Monday at the Supreme Court, in this case dealing with a Washington State high school coach who was praying at and with students on the 50-yard line at football games.
And Patrick Elliott is the attorney who wrote the eloquent amicus brief representing the Freedom From Religion Foundation, opposing the coach's so-called claim to have a freedom to pray with students. And during the show, Sam pointed out that the emphasis during the oral arguments seemed to be more on the issue of coercion than on the traditional issues that we've been used to hearing of endorsement or of advancing religion in the historical Lemon Test.
That was a point that Kennedy's attorneys really emphasized during the oral argument, was that it's coercion here that matters, and they're advocating for the Supreme Court to use this case as the case to overturn the Lemon Test and the endorsement test as well, which are the traditional tests that focus on what the Establishment Clause is meant to protect, which is you can't have the government endorsing religion and promoting it to people, which Kennedy's prayers are clearly doing here, and you can't undertake government activity with the purpose of advancing religion.
They had a good discussion and taking questions from viewers, too, on that Ask an Atheist show.
I might point out that when they talk about the Lemon Test, it's named for our honorary director, the late Alton Lemon, a lovely man from the Philadelphia area, a black freethinker who was the lead plaintiff in that case that came down with three prongs that codified the Supreme Court law on when something is a violation of the separation of church and state.
And the Christian right now wants to just ignore the Lemon Test, and they're telling the court to ignore that Lemon Test. You can watch that entire Ask an Atheist show with Sam and Patrick on FFRF's YouTube channel. Go to the YouTube channel for FFRF and look for the Ask an Atheist playlist. And then next week we'll have another Ask an Atheist.
Yeah,
you can
tune
in live.
And we're going to be, Mark Dan, our lobbyist in D.C., and I are going to be interviewing Nebraska Senator Megan Hunt, who's an atheist who killed an anti-abortion trigger law there. So you don't want to miss that. And then let's talk about those arguments. And we are seeing that there are few boundary lines being drawn in this Coach Kennedy case. We were hoping that the Supreme Court would moot the case. And part of our brief pointed out that Coach Kennedy moved to Florida. And it's a $5,000 a year job, and this should moot the case. Under typical Supreme Court rules, he would no longer have a standing to sue. But they seem to be changing the rules for religious privileging purposes.
So even though they were talking a lot about coercion, Justice Kagan was asking some questions of the attorneys, and she got right to the heart of the issue.
I mean, really, why? Why can the school discipline him? And I'm going to just sort of suggest and find out whether you agree that if you look at our prayer cases, the idea of why the school can discipline him is that that puts a kind of undue pressure, a kind of coercion on students to participate in religious activities when they may not wish to, when their religion is different or when they have no religion. Is that correct?
So, I think it's simpler than that, quite frankly.
I think a lot of this Garcetti stuff is just not getting to the heart of what our cases have long cared about in thinking about these questions, which is coercion on students and having students feel that they have to join religious activities that they do not wish to join, that their parents do not wish them to join.
And I just have to say, the coercion has never been the test. Endorsement has been the test. That the government shouldn't be endorsing religion, and they're ready to throw that out. So Justice Sotomayor shared Kagan's concerns.
What do I do with the facts that parents complain that their children wouldn't follow their directives, not because they wanted to pray, but because they felt pressure to pray? What do I do with the fact that when the school explicitly said students don't have to come if they don't want, many of them didn't, some still did, but many of them didn't. And what do we do with the fact that a coach from another team was the one who brought this to the school's attention? Because your client asked him and his players to join in the prayers. Don't those facts suggest the very coercion that Justice Kagan was talking about?
So even if it is a coercion test, there obviously is coercion here, direct or indirect.
Well, because if you want to play, you shouldn't have to pray to play. And any a captive audience of students or student athletes at the mercy of their coach trying to get his goodwill are obviously going to try to placate him.
And even some of the conservative justices acknowledged the fact that of coercion that a high school coach does exert over the players. Here is Justice Kavanaugh.
What about the player who thinks, if I don't participate in this, I won't start next week? Or the player who thinks, if I do participate in this, I will start next week, and the player's like, wants to start?
So that's where I think making a clear message that that's inappropriate, that this doesn't matter for those purposes, that's how you deal with those problems. And if there is a coach
or
a teacher...
How will you ferret that out? Because every player is trying to get on the good side of the coach, and every parent is worried about the coach exercising favoritism in terms of the starting lineup, playing time, recommendations for colleges, et cetera.
So that decision is going to come down sometime this early summer.
That's right. Kavanaugh was talking to the attorney for the praying coach. So let's not hold our breath and let's certainly not pray about this decision coming down.
At least they're saying that it shouldn't yet unravel all of the good precedent against the prayer cases.
Official prayer,
but it's the beginning.
So we're going to take another break here, and after the break we're going to hear from the exciting and scintillating Phil Zuckerman, the sociologist and author who spoke at our convention last fall, who will tell us that the data supports the fact that non-religious people as a group are actually more moral than religious. I'm Annie Laurie. I'm Dan Barker. I'm not Annie Laurie.
Who are you?
I was reading my notes.
I'm Annie Laurie. Gamer.
And I'm Dan Barker. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio after this.
Hi, I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. And we want to talk a little bit about Phil Zuckerman. He is a professor of sociology and of secular studies at Pitzer College in Claremont, California. We've had him on the show a lot. He specializes in the sociology of secularity. And he is the author of several books, including Living the Secular Life, What It Means to Be Moral, Society Without God, and Faith No More. He also has a new book out about morality and secularity. And that's what he talked about at FFRS recent national convention in November of 2021. And we are going to excerpt that speech. A very good speech, and he is an excellent spokesperson for secularity. He is so cheerful. Some of you know that his mother was the original Gidget. Hmm. He's inherited some of that personality, and so he has a lot to tell us, and we're going to listen.
Yeah, let me start with a couple stories to get things going. As I was preparing for this, I was just trying to think and think about what I've been experiencing lately, what we've been going through. This just kept sticking in my like sand in a jar of Vaseline. I just couldn't get it out. So it was, I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 months ago, things were opening up in L.A. I live in Los Angeles. My older daughter lives in a nice hip part of LA. It's called Silver Lake. And restaurants were just opening up. Things were opening up. And so my wife and I drove across town to have a dinner with her and her boyfriend at an outdoor patio at a hip, cool place in Silver Lake. And we were so excited, first time out to dinner like this. And we parked, and just as we were parking, I saw a crowd of folks. They had some guitars and some signs. And it just so happened that this restaurant my daughter picked was across the street from a Planned Parenthood. And these people were organizing a protest. It was early evening, so Planned Parenthood had already closed, but they were out there on the street, and they had all these pro-life signs and protect babies and protect life and love life. So as we're walking by, there was a leader there, this woman, and she was handing out signs. And of course, they had all these signs saying life, pro-life, you know, Jesus, God, pro-life, and none of them were wearing masks. So as the woman approached me with a thing, I said, no thanks. I said, you said you're pro-life, why aren't you wearing a mask? I mean, you know, the pandemic was still, you know, things were getting better, but we were all still needing to protect ourselves. And she said, God will protect me. And I looked down, I said, you're wearing shoes. And she said, I'm on the city street, you know. I'm like, right? You're wearing glasses. Well, I'm nearsighted or far, right? Yeah. Actually, you're wearing clothes. You know, and now she's offended. Wow, so your God, you know, you have to wear shoes because you don't want to damage your feet. You got to wear clothes to protect you from the elements. And you're wearing glasses because God won't cure your vision. And yet God will protect you from this pandemic, this bug, this virus. And to me, it spoke volumes. Of course, my kids were like pulling me, come on, not again, not again. Okay, we're going to come back to that, but I was thinking, how can I contrast this with some of the work I do and the way I think about these issues? And I remembered what happened to a cousin of mine and his mom, my aunt, Edna. So I have some relatives in Denmark where I've been fortunate to live a couple years. Many years ago, a cousin who's actually my age, this is, you know, a long time ago, when he was 2, started having symptoms, wasn't doing well, wasn't feeling well, wasn't healthy, test after test after test after test, hospitals, this, that, not a good time, not a fun time. When the test came back that he had childhood leukemia, his mom, my Aunt Edna, was at the hospital, and when the diagnosis came in, that, yeah, he's got leukemia. He's 3 years old at this point. A young woman shows up at the hospital, enters where my aunt is, and says, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I am, you know, so sorry about your son, understand the diagnosis, so I am here for you. I will be your personal secretary. I will be answering any mail you have. I will be paying your bills. I will be taking out your trash. I will be cleaning your house. I will be doing your laundry, I will be doing your grocery shopping, and I am just here for you for anything you need, because you need to focus on your son now who's sick. You know how much this was going to cost to have this person? Free, subsidized by the National Healthcare of Denmark. This woman was a social worker who was paid through taxes to help parents like this in need so they don't have to deal with job stuff, bills there just so because their kid is having a tough time health-wise. By the way, my cousin survived and is alive and well today, doing fine. To me, these two stories kind of illustrate to me the difference here between a kind of theologically based morality, a kind of religious morality, and a secular humanist-based morality. In the first one, you have, with religion, a kind of presented moral superiority, first of all, that is actually depraved and harmful. And in the second one, in a kind of secular humanist situation, a very understated, less touted morality. No one in Denmark is running around saying, look how morally superior we are with our universal health care. Look how morally superior we are by paying attention to the dictates of science and empiricism. Look how morally superior we are by taking care of people in need. They don't say that. It's not blasted. And yet, it's actually alleviating suffering, which to me is the goal of any moral system, right? Or legal system. So it's interesting to me how this plays out in our world, especially here in the United States, where the moral high ground is claimed by those that are doing the most damage often. And those of us that work to make the world a better place, work to alleviate suffering, we do so out of humanist values that are not proclaimed as such necessarily and are certainly not recognized as such by the wider society. And we've got to change that. The question is not how can you be moral if you don't believe in God, but how can you be moral if you believe in God? Oh, man, easy crowd, easy crowd. I was going to say, I spent all week thinking of, I was going to say, oh, here I am preaching to the converted. And I was like, no, I can't use that. So I've been thinking like, here I am pontificating to the informed and educated. How's that? Is that a good? Okay. So now, one of the things that I try and teach my students, of course, is I'm a sociologist by training. You know, you can find an anecdote to illustrate anything, right? Anecdotes are not necessarily, I mean, they're fun, they're good, they're illustrative, they're engaging. But, you know, you can, they're not, it's not solid data, right? And so I'm always pushing my students and I'm saying, you know, when you're in a debate with somebody, you know, it's a good idea to present their arguments in the best of light and then show why it's wrong, not find a certain anecdote that's a straw man type situation. So you could think, well, Phil's picked these two anecdotes, but they're not really reflective of what's going on. Not so. We've got the data. We've got the data. On today's burning moral, ethical issues, we've got clear, clear, strong correlations. The more religious you are, you fall on one side of these issues, and the more secular you are, you fall on another. And by the way, just so you know, I'm often told by people, well, Phil, there's a lot of liberal religious people out there who agree with your positions. And I'm like, right, because they have a secularized version of religion. I mean, hello. You know, I know friends, you know, nice Episcopalians and Reformed Jews and all, and you know, progressive Catholics. And I'm like, right. And on every issue, they don't take things literally. They don't take the Bible literally. Their God is not the, you know, it's all because they are leaning towards the secular side of things. And of course, that's why we join hands on these issues. But so let me walk us through some of them. I don't want this just to be a rambling list here, but I think it's so important. So when we sit back and think, okay, what are we facing today? At least in the United States. Who among us here in the United States is doing the most to alleviate suffering? Who follows the stay-in-place mandates? Who wears masks? Who gets the vaccine? We've got the data. Atheist Americans are the most likely to get vaccinated in this country. And that's an altruistic act because you're trying to help everyone, not just yourself. You know, some people say to me, like, isn't it my right if I don't want to get a vaccine and don't want to wear a mask? I'm like, is it your right to drink and drive? Like, give me a break. You're causing suffering. You're causing unwanted victims here. So when it comes just to the basic pandemic, we see our morals are not only just as good as the religious, but better, more active and engaged in helping others and solving others. So I think about the climate crisis, right? Who's more likely to understand the climate crisis and want to take action to alleviate it? The more secular you are, the more you fall on that. Just for example, recent PRRI study found that over 80% of secular Americans accept the evidence that human activity is causing climate change, and they place addressing climate change at the top of the list of their political priorities, while only 33% of white evangelicals accept such evidence. And yet it's the white evangelicals that have been running this country for the last, you know, previous 4 years, ran the White House, packed the Supreme Court, packed the lower courts, the appellate courts, the circuit courts. Whew, we got our work cut out for us. Thank goodness there's FFRF. My goodness. I cannot tell you what an honor and the work they do and how many people I refer to them when they're in legal straits. Anyway, women's reproductive rights are under assault right now in our country, right? The women's ability to have autonomy over their own bodies. And again, we see In fact, FFRF did some excellent research on their own membership, and I consider members of FFRF the most committed to the secularist cause out there. And what do we see among supporting women's reproductive rights? 98.8% of active secular voters and FFRF members support women's reproductive rights. Yes, that is the highest rate there.
And we will hear the rest of sociologist and author Phil Zuckerman's speech to the Freedom From Religion Foundation after the break, where we will then talk about racism and attitudes about society that differ between the religious and the non-religious.
Member of FFRF and promoter of Real Wellness Lifestyles. I'm no longer willing to say, in God I trust, so help me God, God bless America, or pretend America is more under a God than any other nation. Join the resistance to Christian nationalism and politicians more attentive to what they think God wants than the needs of their constituents. Let's make separation of church and state a reality and turn back the drift to theocracy. Support FFRF. Our freedom really does depend on freethinkers.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, "No gods, no masters." This is Free Thought Radio.
I am Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are in the middle of listening to Phil Zuckerman's address to FFRF's most recent convention, and he is a sociology professor and a pioneer of secular studies. And by the way, you can watch his speech at our website. Just go to the outreach and events link, and when you click on conventions, past conventions will come up, and our videos are up there, also on our YouTube channel. And the text of his speech will be running in the upcoming issue of Free Thought Today in June, July. But meanwhile, you're getting a sneak preview, so let's continue with Phil Zuckerman.
Race and racism, the deep poison, the deep crimes of this nation, right? Where do we stand? It was really interesting. There was a woman, Deborah Hall, I believe at Duke, who wanted to do a study on racism and religion. And she wanted to show how, you know, the more religious care more about racism, are concerned more about racism, particularly she's talking about white Americans here. So she did a meta-study. She gathered every legitimate national sample she could find that had a representative sample of folks about correlating religiosity to racism to see where Americans fell. And surprise, surprise, what was her finding? Agnostics, atheists, and secular humanists reported the lowest levels of racism and racist among white Americans compared to all other religions, liberal, conservative, fundamentalist, there it was. And we see this time and time again, which is interesting because both the secular and the religious tell a kind of story about the unity of humanity, right? Every religion claims that this daddy God, we're all this daddy God's children, so we're all brothers and sisters. Secular humanists know a different story. It's that we all come from primates, and we all share we're all the same species. One story has data and evidence to support it. The other is a myth. What's interesting is, where do we fall? Those of us that accept the scientific, evidence-based notion of all being one, we live that out more, we act out that more, and even in our politics reflect that. So that's not to say we don't have a racist problem. It's hard to live in the United States and not internalize that racism. And yet, on these measures, the best measures we have, the more secular you are, the less likely you are to express those and act on those. And I'm proud of that. Let me see. I got some data here, actually. Some percentages. Among Americans who believe that racial discrimination is a major problem in the U.S., 76% of all Americans say so, but 96% of active secularist members like you say it is such. And here's this interesting one, supporting reparations for slavery. About 20% of Americans say they are in favor of such. 45% of FFRF members and secularist voters say as much. Still not a majority, but wow, it's up there, highest rate. Whether it's LGBTQ rights, whether it's animal rights, whether it's wanting to stem gun violence, whether it's caring for the well-being of democracy, whether it's helping refugees fleeing suffering, whether it's supporting death with dignity, on issue after issue after issue that actually relates to how people experience the world and whether or not they're going to suffer or thrive, secular humanists come down on the moral, ethical side and the more religious folks on the opposite. And this needs to be known, and this needs to be trumpeted, and this needs to be hammered, and this needs to be asserted. So that's the what. So now the question is why? Why does it play out this way? Well, I would argue that the foundations are quite different here. When you accept that there's no magical beings out there, and it's just us on this planet spinning round, you tend to frame your morality or base it on empathy and compassion. Empathy and compassion. For each one of those issues that I've raised, you just go there. Not on obedience to an imaginary and vengeful God. Clearly that doesn't hold up. We base our worldview on a here and now-ness. I'm sure there's a word for that in German that's just perfect, but we don't really have that in English. But we live in the here and now. And all that that means, rather than living our lives yearning for pie in the sky and the by and by. And that's going to affect decisions we make, plans we make, politicians we support, things we care about. Also, as I've already mentioned, there's a real deep cosmopolitanism, universalism embedded in our worldview. In every setting we have, the more religious you are, the more tribalistic you are. Religiosity and tribalism, xenophobia, nationalism are highly, highly correlated. Again, that's not to say there aren't some secular humanists out there that are xenophobic and tribalistic and so on and so forth. However, the correlation is robust. That we are actually more cosmopolitan, meaning we see ourselves as citizens of the world much more than the religious, who see themselves much more in terms of their membership to a particular tribe, a particular group, which is conducive towards in-group sympathy and out-group antipathy. And we all have to struggle with that. It's part of our evolutionary past. But somehow, for some reason, the secular folks, we seem to be, have progressed farther along on that, expanding that circle, as Peter Singer talked about. And finally, another sort of cardinal virtue, I got to think of a secular version of that for us secular folks, is scientific empiricism. We are interested in things like data and evidence and research. And we tend to heed it. We know it's not perfect. We know it's flawed. But we know that it is a method that is self-improving. Whenever science comes up, the scientific method, some student always says, oh, science, you know, science is terrible. I mean, science has done so many bad things. Science has made so many mistakes. They said this, and then that was wrong, and they said this, and that was wrong. And I said, well, you could only prove that that was wrong through better science. How did you know that that was wrong? How did you know that that was harmful? There's only one way to know how many teeth are in a horse's mouth, and that's the count. So we understand this sort of value of the scientific method rather than rely on myths, fantasies, and prayers. And that's not to say that some people in really tough situations need myths, fantasies, and prayers to get through the night. I understand that. But our job, as I see it, is to address the conditions that are producing the suffering, not simply provide myths and fantasies in the wake of that suffering. To me, that's not the way to do it. And we're actually living that in the choices we make, the pursuits we pursue, and the political choices we make. So that's the good news, as far as I'm concerned. So thank you so much for listening.
And that is sociologist and author Phil Zuckerman speaking at FFRF's annual convention last fall.
And our upcoming convention next fall, the last weekend of October. It's October Friday. It's a full day Friday and Saturday, October 28th and 29th, is in San Antonio, where our theme is Do Mess with Texas. And our speakers include the Texas progressive icon, Jim Hightower, John Irving, the novelist, Godless Gospel, which has many African-American free-thinking stars who are also good singers, and there's going to be a panel on losing your faith as an African-American free-thinker. We have an 18-year-old Max Nybert from West Virginia who led his class in a walkout against proselytizing in the public schools as our lead plaintiff. We have an 11-year-old girl getting an activist award, Al Harris, who wrote Al the Humanist, Alice Gretchen, Dare to Doubt, the actress, Daniel Mack from ACLU. I'm missing a lot of people, but we talked about Amy Harris Miller, who is going to be talking about, she's running the abortion clinics there in Texas. And our attorneys will be giving their annual report. There'll be our annual non-prayer breakfast, and so much more. So you can, it's not too early to sign up at fffrf.org. Go to the outreach and events page and you'll see the convention lineup there.
In October in San Antonio. So that's our show for today. We want to greet our listeners in Philadelphia to WOOM, in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania to WZML, Madison, Wisconsin, WIDE, WMUU, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, KEOS in College Station in Bryan, Texas, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, KEPW in Eugene, Oregon, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, WOO Black Sheep Radio in Bellows Falls, Vermont, WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And by the way, our Free Thought Matters TV show is also being broadcast on the radio, WRIU-FM 90.3 in Kingston, Rhode Island, at the University of Rhode Island, is airing that show. If you want to get up every Friday morning at 5:30. If you're listening to us on the podcast, give us a thumbs up on your provider and tell your friends and family to visit Free Thought Radio at fffrf.org/radio.
Yeah, and we would appreciate your joining us in our very vital work to keep religion out of government and for reason to prevail. You can get more information at our website at fffrf.org. You can just sign up there at the join or donate link, and we'd be very grateful to have you swell our ranks. And we invite you to tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Thought Radio is...
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. If you're on Twitter, we're on Twitter handle TheTaxCast. If you want to make sure you never miss a TaxCast, just email me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so this month on The TaxCast, oligarchs behaving badly, governments behaving badly. This time, the scandal goes all the way to Downing Street, the heart of the British government, and the UK Chancellor, the Finance Minister, and his wife's extraordinary wealth. We all knew she had enormous inherited wealth, £11.5 million a year in dividends from her stake in her father's IT business based in India. But it turns out she opted to minimise her taxes using an archaic status to do so. She's a non-dom. So what is a non-dom? Non-dom status refers to a person who is not domiciled in the UK. That doesn't mean they don't live in the UK. It just means that if one of their parents was born overseas, they can choose to claim this status, which saves them lots of tax. The UK Finance Minister's wife could well be avoiding £2 to 5 million a year in taxes because of the non-dom status she's opted for. Unlike most UK residents, non-doms don't pay UK tax on their worldwide income and capital gains, if you've got any worldwide income. The outrage of even this Conservative Member of Parliament in this parliamentary committee hearing pretty much sums up the anger of voters. Bear in mind, it's his party's finance minister's wife, just as her husband is currently raising taxes on the poorest people, especially as they face a cost of living crisis.
I mean, it's extraordinary, frankly.
Absolutely.
And you wonder why people want...
It's a policy issue.
Yeah, I know it's a policy issue, and it's nothing to do with you. You're just the bloke in charge. I realise that. But, I mean, in all honesty, you're surprised that people think there's one set of rules for the rich people and one set of rules for someone else, when you've just told us that that's exactly what there is.
And not only that, but both the finance minister, the chancellor, and his wealthy wife pledged permanent residence to the United States as green card holders while he was member of parliament and finance minister. I mean, we can legitimately ask, do politicians and their families believe in the societies they serve or not? Are they a part of it all or not? So far in the UK, only 5 of the 22 cabinet ministers are willing to confirm publicly whether they or their families benefit either from offshore holdings or from non-dom status. Back in 2015, I interviewed the amazing award-winning journalist from Pakistan, Umar Chima. We spoke about his inspirational achievement in making Pakistan only the 4th country in the world to publish the tax returns of its parliamentarians. I'll put the link to that interview in the show notes. This is what he told me at the time.
Interestingly, a senior finance ministry official told me that when the government of Pakistan announced the decision to make tax data public, they got to hear from the UK authorities that now we will come under pressure for doing the same in UK. I don't know when they do, but one should hope for the best, and the Tax Justice Network must use the example of Pakistan for pressuring the authorities in London.
Britain today and many other nations are still light years away from following Pakistan's example and putting the tax affairs of their elected representatives into the spotlight. I'm going to speak with one of the co-authors of a new report which for the first time unmasks the kind of people who are using this archaic non-dom status in the UK. They released their report just as the scandal about the finance minister's wife broke. Happy timing to get major attention onto something fundamentally unjust. But first, I'm going to speak with economist John Christensen. Okay, John, so non-dom status is something we've spoken about quite a few times on the TaxCast, and as is so often the case with these things, this is yet another example of how oligarchs behave. And we can apply that term to all the super rich. It doesn't just apply to Russians. They just live in a parallel universe where taxation applied to ordinary people doesn't apply to them and borders don't apply to them. Now it looks like the UK finance minister's wife, the chancellor's wife, has pretty much damaged her husband's political career, because there's a lot of anger from ordinary people about the hypocrisy of tax minimisation by the family of the man who's setting our tax policy in the UK and has done absolutely nothing to help citizens in the cost of living crisis they face. She's now said she'll pay tax voluntarily in the UK. And it's important to make clear that she can say, hand on heart, that she's paying all taxes that are due completely legally, partly through her non-dom status. But also, interestingly, she's got the payouts on her huge inherited wealth routed through the tax haven of Mauritius. So she's likely to be paying zero tax there. And this is very much what we call unearned income. So a thing that's so undertaxed compared to what we all work to earn.
Yep, so look, we've discussed the non-dom rules many times, and we've also campaigned for its abolition. But bear in mind the following. Firstly, domicile has nothing to do with citizenship. You can hold an Indian passport, as Miss Murthy does,
but live and work in London and pay UK taxes on your income. Secondly, being non-domiciled is a personal choice. You actually need to apply to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs to be deemed to be non-domiciled in the UK. And equally, if you want to pay taxes in the UK in the same way as the vast majority of ordinary people do, then you can give up your non-dom status, and you can do this without in any way undermining your Indian citizenship. And thirdly, that when Ms. Murthy's spokesperson claims, as they did, that she has been paying all the taxes she is legally liable to pay, this statement needs to be unbundled very carefully indeed, because it is almost certain that most people won't understand the implications of what is being said. Because most people are used to being taxed on a pay-as-you-earn basis, and they don't receive unearned income from wealth held in an offshore holding company. So in light of the scandal that blew up, especially after her husband went ahead with increasing the national insurance contribution rates, which apply to most workers, Ms. Murthy has reportedly chosen to give up her non-dom status and will henceforth be paying UK tax on all her worldwide income. But unfortunately for her and for her husband, the reputational harm caused when her non-dom status was revealed is probably irreversible, and her husband's long-held ambition to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has probably been holed below the waterline. That's because if there's something the wider public really hate, it's the notion that there's one rule for super-rich people and another rule entirely for ordinary people.
Yeah, and especially while he was raising taxes on everybody else.
Yeah.
So the UK's kind of really archaic non-dom status has influenced other nations. I mean, Italy, where I am at the moment, they introduced something that was inspired by the UK. At the same time, political opposition in the UK did actually persuade the government to scale it back a bit. And I do mean a bit, because they put a 15-year time limit on it and they made it more expensive after a while. So the cost of £30,000 a year fee, which is over $37,500 a year, to £60,000 a year, and that's about $75,000 a year, more than most of us earn in a full year. So it's obviously well worth it for these non-doms. And tax havens elsewhere also have all kinds of unjustifiable assorted advantages. And really, all of this means that we must redefine the principles that should govern us all equally, right?
Oh, absolutely, because see, the non-dom rule and the equivalent rules in many other countries come out of a particular ideology, a tax haven ideology. And it's worth just a look at that ideology and understand why politicians think it's worthwhile targeting tax breaks at the super rich people. The argument goes that super rich people are super mobile. They can choose to locate themselves anywhere, Monaco 1 month, Palm Beach the next. They can choose to locate their financial assets and their wealth anywhere, Cayman Island, Mauritius, wherever. So paying tax for the super rich is entirely a voluntary matter. There's a perceptible public sense that the rules, especially the tax rules, are biased to the interests of the very wealthiest people in society. And the wider public, especially in Britain, but I think the same can be said in Italy and in France, are paying high levels of tax whilst receiving increasingly poor quality of public services. So the non-dom rule, as far as I'm concerned, epitomises this sense of fracture of the social contract and the gradual erosion of people's commitment to democracy. And that's why we need this whole new set of governing principles to re-establish some sense of a social contract here in Europe and elsewhere in the world where similar tax breaks have been given to the super rich.
Yeah, and what governments everywhere always say to justify these kinds of privileges for the very wealthy is it encourages investment. And I'm going to speak in a minute to the co-author of a really important report on non-dom status about how much that really is a load of nonsense. But when it comes to the term investment, that's a really, really tricky word, isn't it? Because actually, it's worthy of an entire tax cast in itself, which is something I've intended to do for a while.
Yeah, well, the word investment, as far as I'm concerned, is just a catch-all word used by lazy economists and politicians to confuse the public and obfuscate. As far as I'm concerned, much of what is termed investments, particularly inward investment, doesn't flow into new facilities or researching new technologies. Instead, it goes into acquiring or merging with existing businesses, often leading to job cuts, and often consolidating the market power of major companies who might already have monopolistic powers in that market. So, absolutely. Let's go ahead. Let's have that addition of the tax cost. Let's discuss this matter, because we need to bring pressure to bear on the economists and the national statisticians who provide the data on so-called investments, because we need to have a much better understanding of whether all these tax breaks to super-rich people are actually leading to real investment in new jobs and new ideas and new services, or are they actually helping just the super rich and everyone apart from the super rich find their situation being eroded by the lack of investment into new wealth creating activities?
Thanks, John. Economist John Christensen. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature, the UK's non-doms. Who are they? What do they do? And where do they live? What does it tell us about wealth and fairness? Now we have a new report just out. For the first time, the data on non-doms has been mined by a team of economists and data specialists. We now have a picture of the UK's non-doms. These are people who are paying a non-dom fee from £30,000 to £60,000 a year. That's more than most of us earn in an entire year. It helps us definitively answer the question, what is the point of non-dom status? Who does it serve? I'm speaking to Aaron Advani of the University of Warwick, one of the report's authors. So, hi Aaron, the most obvious question is, how do you get non-dom status?
You're non-dom just as a fact of your existence. So you either are or aren't a non-dom, and that just is a function of whether your permanent home is the UK or not the UK. So if you're born here, brought up here, through a British parent, and you expect to live here the rest of your life, you're a UK domiciled person. This is your permanent home. If, however, you come from another country and you intend potentially to go back there, then you would be a non-dom, and that will apply to, you know, many, many people. Then there's a separate question that's been coming up recently, which is about whether you are sort of a non-dom for tax purposes. And this is really a question about whether you choose to tick a box on the tax form that says, I wish to benefit from the remittance basis, which is a particular status that you get if you're a non-dom. So if you're a UK dom, you don't have the option of that box. But if you're a non-dom, you can tick that box. And ticking that box says, I don't have to declare or pay tax on foreign investment income until such time as I bring that income into the UK. And if I never bring that income into the UK, then I will never pay tax on that income. And so that's kind of what all the recent debate has been about, has been there are people who tick a box on the tax form that gives them this particular benefit that says, if I keep my income from investments offshore, I won't have to be paying tax on it in the UK, and potentially I may not be paying tax on it anywhere in the world.
Right. It's the first time that the data on non-DOMs has been analysed like this in Britain. So I just wanted to ask you if you can describe the data that you've had access to, the data you used, and why you wanted to do this research.
So the data that we're using is from the UK Tax Authority. We go and sit in a secured room in the what's called the Data Lab in Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. And sitting in that secure room where we have no access to our phones or computers or anything else, of our own computers, we can use a secured set of computers that give us access to completely anonymized data. So I can't see anything about individuals in their personal capacities, their names or dates of birth or anything like that. But I can see anonymized data on all of the details you'd basically see on the tax form. So I can see what they filed as their level of income and what all of those like subcomponents on different boxes of the tax form are. So that's what we can see.
And why did you want to analyze this data?
Just at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a bit of a debate around wealth taxes and whether they would be the answer to what is going on in the pandemic and how we'd pay for it. And we had questions from journalists asking us, you know, what did we think? We felt like we ought to have an answer, and we didn't really have a good answer to that question. We didn't think we knew the answer. And so we set up the Wealth Tax Commission to go and study the kind of broader question about wealth taxes. And when we were doing that, you know, one of the areas that was most striking to us was we just really didn't have very good evidence on what goes on at the very top of the income distribution. And we have basically no information about wealth. because the UK doesn't tax wealth directly, and so we don't store any information on this. And that obviously seems like a bit of a policy gap, because you can't really answer questions like what would happen if you did this or did that to wealthy people if you don't have evidence on it. And as I say, these data are really nice because they are, you know, data for every single person in the tax system in the country. So it gives you the chance to kind of try and explore some of these big questions. And so we wanted to understand a bit more about the non-doms, but this first piece was really trying to understand just who are they? Like, what kind of people are benefiting from the system? You know, their ages, their sex, where they come from, where they live in the UK, what are they doing in the UK? Those are the kind of questions we wanted to understand. What is the total benefit they're getting? How would they respond if we were to reform the system? And do they do brilliant stuff in terms of creating jobs, or do they have really negative effects on house prices? We don't know right now. We'd love to know that. And once we understand the answer to that kind of question, we can then think overall collectively about, you know, what would a sensible policy look like in this area.
Lots of really important questions. Incredible how little data we have in the UK on wealth. And here's some nuggets from the findings of this new report, the UK's non-doms. Who are they? What do they do? And where do they live? You'll find the link in the show notes. So here you go. 3 in 10 people who earned £5 million or more claimed non-dom status in 2018. More than 1 in 5 top-earning bankers is a non-dom. Most non-doms are men. Non-doms are highly represented in finance and city jobs. Most non-doms come from Western Europe, India and the United States. And since 2001, there's been a rapid rise in the number of non-doms from India, China and the former Soviet states. And most non-doms live in and around London in the most expensive districts. There's lots more. I really encourage you to read the report. So, Aaron, what surprised you most about your findings? I mean, for me, what surprised me a lot was the answer to one of your many great questions in the report, which was, are non-doms workers or rentiers? And it turns out around 80% of non-doms, as you say in the report, have got earnings from some kind of work or pension income as their main source of income. That means a lot of them seem to be engaged in substantial paid work. That is interesting. I also realise that there are caveats around that because the data you've looked at are based on reported income only, and it likely underestimates total income, given that one of the key benefits of non-dom status is that they don't have to report or pay tax on their foreign source income unless it comes into the UK. So that's one of the unknowables. But yes, I kind of pictured someone not doing very much, sitting in their jacuzzi, quaffing champagne, but many are actually working.
Yes, that's one of my top three. And I think so the finding, as you say, is that, you know, 80% of them have in the income that they declare, the main source of income is some kind of work or, you know, in a small number of cases, pensions. And I guess that kind of is different to what people have in their mind of someone coming here, you know, an oligarch or whatever, who lives here but lives off some big foreign investment income wealth. In the most part, it's not people who are coming here and sitting on their bum living off that foreign income. They may well also have lots of that foreign income, but they're also here and doing something here. They're in the labour market. They are working. The second thing sort of related to that work issue is, you know, what are they doing? What kinds of work are they doing? The biggest group are in banking, which, you know, maybe people aren't surprised. You know, finance is where there's lots of money in the UK, and we're not surprised these people are well off. But I think I was surprised by the scale of it. So 1 in 5 people working in a bank who are in the top 1%, basically, you know, earning more than about £125,000. 1 in 5 of those are non-doms. And I think the third thing that I found really striking was when we did this kind of geographic picture of where people are, one of the areas that lit up was Manchester. So we thought, well, what's going on in Manchester? And you see that there are these very young people in Manchester who are in the sports industry, who are non-doms. And a youngish footballer is probably not what I would have first thought of as a major group of non-doms. And there aren't loads of them. They're not a huge number of them, as you kind of can imagine from the size of the teams that are out there. As I say, you know, we don't know who any of the individuals are. We don't know what teams they play for. But given that they're in Manchester and they're non-doms and they're in sports, it's probably that they're footballers. But you can also see that they're very high incomes. Their kind of average incomes for those non-doms are about £2 million. So that's really high. And again, that's £2 million is the bit that's not including any foreign investment income they may have. So I think that was kind of my third really striking thing. It's just this group of people that I hadn't really imagined who are out there.
It's interesting. And I mean, in terms of the typical profile of non-DOMs, I mean, we have to generalise quite a bit, obviously, but it's really interesting. It's a lot younger than I thought it might be. You know, you say the age bracket has a tendency to be in late 30s to early 40s, and not surprisingly to me, most of them are men. There's only under 35% of non-DOMs are women.
Yeah, so having started with, you know, here are the ones that are not the typical ones, here are the ones I found surprising, I guess the thing we can say about the typical non-DOM is that the typical non-DOM is that kind of man you might picture. As you say, you know, about a third of them are women, about two-thirds are men, which actually is a slightly higher ratio of women than you'd expect for just if you took generally high-income people. So there are slightly more women in that group. They're, you know, middle-aged, in work, probably in some kind of city job, so most likely in finance, something like banking, but also in working consultancy, working in other kinds of support services that relate to banking, finance, business type things in the city. And yeah, and they're living in the southeast. They're living in London or the surrounding areas.
And the actual proportion of people that we're talking about here, whilst it's a tiny proportion, I think you said 490,000 unique individuals who have claimed non-DOM status from 2001 to 2018 while being UK residents at some point. That total, that's 1% equivalent of all UK adults. But they do have a disproportionately large impact in terms of these tax-based decisions. And I'm assuming that they're tax-based decisions they made to claim non-DOM status with the tax authorities. And there's a lot of sort of unknowable questions that your research raises, right? What sort of things do we not know? I mean, in terms of the impact to the UK, we know they paid over £7 million in 2020, £7 million in income tax, capital gains, national insurance, and that doesn't seem very much to me.
Yes, I mean, I think there's big questions for us. Just how much tax would there be in a world in which every non-DOM who was currently in the country had to stay in the country, and you could just work out how much tax sort of would they pay if they paid the same tax as everybody else. But the really hard bit is actually just to get a sense for what is the tax base, how much money is there out there that is potentially taxable if you were to change the tax system in some way. The question is just how will people respond? But that very first question, because we don't even ask what is the income that you're not having to pay tax on, what are the gains that you're not paying tax on, because we don't even ask that question, we don't even know what is that base. It's really hard to have an informed policy discussion, or, you know, if you were a minister and right now you were going to ask the tax authority to tell you, well, what is the effect of doing this reform? You know, how much money is out there? I think they could go and do some of the things that we're going to try and do, which is to do complicated ways to estimate what that would look like. But it would be much simpler if it was just on a form somewhere, like it is for most things, where you can say, okay, here's how much money there is out here, and this is what we can kind of get. And then having answered how much money's out there and answered how will people respond, the third question is, what are the other effects that that has on the economy? Is it the case that it will lead to slower growth, or will it help bring down house prices, or will it change how dynamic companies are? Will it change the number of patents we produce? All of those other economic questions we'd quite like to know the answer to beyond the tax benefit. And it's not clear, you know, whether there are those kind of big effects.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, the argument is that for the nation, it brings in investment, which you wouldn't otherwise get. But that word investment is such a tricky one, because if it's investment in something like the productive economy, or if it's investment in terms of speculative or in property or other investments that aren't necessarily going to bring much benefits to the UK, that's another kind of unknowable question. But I read that in 2019, the government says that non-DOMs invested over £1 million in the UK, which again doesn't sound like very much.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing that's worth remembering in the context of the non-DOM policy is that what the policy does in its current form on remittance basis, which is this tax benefit you get, is it says, if you come to the UK, we'll give you a tax benefit, and that tax benefit is on overseas investment income. So if you have lots of wealth that's generating lots of income, as long as you promise to keep it overseas and not bring it into the UK, we will give you a tax break. So if what you were trying to do was to bring investment into the UK by bringing wealth into the UK and having people invest in, you know, productive stuff here, this is absolutely not the way to do it. This is encouraging people who have lots of wealth to come to the UK and to not bring their wealth to the UK. And if they were to bring their wealth to the UK, then they will not get this benefit. There are, you know, I should say at this point for the legally minded people who are listening, there is something called business investment relief. In principle, that does provide a way in which people could still retain some of the benefit, because it's clear that this is a completely mad system. But it's so hard to use business investment relief that when you look at the statistics, you can see that basically no one is using it. It's just too hard to use it, and nobody kind of tries. It's just easier to keep your money offshore. And so what we see is that we have a regime that explicitly encourages people not to bring their money onshore.
Right, which begs the question, what is the point?
Yeah, and I mean, I think this is a good point to also reflect on the fact that the non-dom regime shouldn't be thought of as something that was designed, in the sense that the remittance basis, which is the thing that lets you have delayed to not pay tax on your overseas income, is a, you know, colonial era thing. It was invented in 1799, around the same time as the income tax. And it basically said, look, if you have income that you get from overseas, you know, in the old days, back in you know, colonial times, you have something, you know, a sugar plantation in the Caribbean or something, you don't have to pay income tax on that income the moment it arises. That is the point at which that income exists. We'll wait until the point which you bring it onshore, because in those days, to trade that sugar or whatever else it was you were trading, you'd have to bring it into Liverpool or some other dock in the UK. You have to bring it onshore before you could then send it back out to somewhere else, to some other colony. And so it was just a deferral of tax. We would just not charge it to you yet. We'll charge it to you at the point that money comes onshore, when you have access to actually touch it. And in the off chance that, you know, the ship sinks or something, then you're never going to pay that tax because you never really got the income. So that, you know, there's some rationale to that. Then over time, there were loads of reforms that kind of narrowed the scope of doing that, and eventually, you know, much later, made it the case that not everyone could benefit from this ability to keep this money offshore. Only people who were non-DOMs could have this benefit. So originally the remittance basis, which is this overseas income isn't taxed at the point that it arises, it was taxed only when it comes onshore, that was available to everybody. Then that later got narrowed down to just people who are not domiciled in the UK. But also over time, as we know, the world has changed. It's no longer the case that this is a tax deferral policy. It's not the case that we're just deferring that tax till some later date when the money comes onshore. Now people can benefit from that money without ever bringing it onshore. And so it's no longer deferring the tax. It's now just saying you could get away with never paying that tax. And that doesn't seem like what it was originally intended to do in any sense. It's also just not the case that it's doing any specific thing that we would currently set down as a goal that policy has. Like, if you start from first principles and say, I have a goal for policy, which is to bring in brilliant, smart, bright people who can come and work in the UK, and to bring in people who have loads of money, who can bring it in and can invest in the UK, then this policy is not doing that, because it's both, in that second case, telling people don't bring that money into the UK, and in that first case, it's not clear that this is the best way you want to encourage those people to come into the UK. Because it's in fact saying to those people, come here, but make sure that in your hearts you keep in mind that you don't want to stay here forever. Because if you come here and you decide that you actually want to stay here and you like living here, and this is where you think your permanent home is quite quickly, then you no longer benefit from this regime. So you better believe that your permanent home is some other country. Which again, you know, if you think these people are brilliant and are doing great stuff here, why discourage them in that way that says, you know, we hope that you are not making a permanent home in the UK. We hope you're just settling for a little while. It was not designed for these goals. If these are the goals you're trying to have, this policy is not achieving them.
No. I mean, it's completely illogical, one of many illogical colonial overhangs, which doesn't make any sense now, unless you're wealthy, powerful and happy to take these unfair advantages. In terms of attracting brilliant people, I mean, in the case of the UK finance minister's wife, as far as I know, there's no entrepreneurial brilliance on her part. She just inherited a stake in her dad's IT business based in India. And the last time I checked, in Britain, only 5 of the 22 cabinet ministers are willing to confirm publicly whether they or their families benefit either from offshore holdings or from non-dom status. I mean, you surely think non-dom status should end.
Yeah, and I do think that non-dom, the domicile as a concept doesn't have a place in the tax system. And there are lots of other things in the system that need fixing. And we happened to get really lucky this time that there was this big news story that you know, with the most ridiculous timing, broke right close to when we were trying to release our stuff. But more broadly, how does one get reform of these kinds of things on the agenda? Because They are niche, they are boring, they are technical. Most people don't know anything about them. Journalists mostly don't have any reason to think about them and are going to find it hard to sell to their editor that this should make an important news story. And so in that environment, how do you fix those things? But, you know, there's all those other things that are out there that we need to make sure that people are thinking about. And that just because there's no news story about them right now, they don't get ignored for, you know, 10 years until there happens to be a news story, and then they get dealt with. We need people to be thinking about them right now.
Oh, he's singing the song of the tax justice movement. But all this boring, technical, niche stuff, fair taxes, is the lifeblood of our nations. We've got to care about it. The political opposition in the UK has now proposed abolishing non-dom status, which is good news that finally this illogical perk of the very wealthy might be at the beginning of the end. And so many other perks need to go with it too, not least the secrecy that protects the rich from the fair taxes that we all contribute. Join me next month on the TaxCast for the results of the latest 2022 Tax Justice Network Financial Secrecy Index. And you can hear how badly your country ranks as a global secrecy offender. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.